You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Maria McKinley.
And I'm Doug Storm. This is the Daily Local News for Monday, August 8th, 2016.
Even if you have a high propensity of becoming an alcoholic, if your family doesn't drink, nobody drinks, you know, you won't become an alcoholic. You just avoid it.
Researchers at Purdue and IU School of Medicine discuss a recent study identifying 939 genes linked to alcoholism. That's coming up later in the show.
Also coming up in the next half hour, a volunteer describes efforts to rescue animals from a dog hoarding situation, as well as raise money for pet care. That's on Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community. But first, these local headlines.
Jurors continued to hear testimony today in the trial of Daniel Messel, who was charged with the murder of Hannah Wilson in April of last year. Wilson was a 22-year-old Indiana University senior due to graduate in May of 2015. The case is being tried in the Brown County Circuit Court because Wilson's body was found in a vacant lot near Helmsburg. Jury selection took 3 days and ended with a panel of 12 jurors, 8 women and 4 men. Several of Wilson's friends testified as to the circumstances surrounding her disappearance the Thursday of Little 500 weekend. After a night of heavy drinking at Kilroy's Sports Bar, Wilson's friends paid for a taxi to take her home. Wilson's roommate reported hearing her enter their house on 8th Street around 1 in the morning. Her body was discovered later that morning before her friends reported her missing. The prosecutors are in the process of presenting the jury with a host of evidence against Daniel Messel. Wilson's body was found with severe head trauma and blood evidence suggesting she was killed at the scene. Investigators discovered a cell phone under her body, which was later found to belong to Messel. When state troopers arrived at Messel's residence, they reported finding Messel holding a bag full of clothing that police say was stained with Wilson's blood. Other evidence presented by the state includes various surveillance footage, blood evidence from Messel's car, and wound patterns indicating a struggle between Messel and Wilson. Messel's attorney has called for a mistrial, criticizing investigators for not obtaining DNA testing on all the evidence at the scene, including a cigarette butt found near the body. The motion was denied, and investigators say the butt was not tested because it appeared older than the murder, and the number of items they could send to the state lab was limited. Defense attorneys are conducting their cross-examinations this week, with the trial expected to last into early next week, according to Herald Times reporter Laura Lane, who has been covering the trial.
The Indiana Forest Alliance has moved to new offices. The organization is a nonprofit advocacy group working to preserve forests and is now located in Indianapolis after working from Bloomington for 20 years. Forest Alliance Executive Director Jeff Stant says the organization formed in Bloomington in 1996 in an effort to preserve the Hoosier National Forest from lumber companies. After the success of that program, Stant says, the community was so supportive of their cause that the Forest Alliance stayed in Bloomington and worked to protect natural resources in the area.
Bloomington has been a tremendous place for the Indiana Forest Alliance. People in that part of the state who had been very involved, and then folks from elsewhere in the state, wanted an organization to continue focusing on our forests, particularly the forests on our public lands, after the national forest management debate subsided in the 1990s. The environmental community didn't want to see that focus go away.
Most recently, the Forest Alliance's offices have been on North Walnut Street. Stant says the Bloomington community has remained supportive even during the move to their new location. He says the Forest Alliance is changing locations because of its increased size and desire to be closer to the state capital so it can be a more effective agent for change.
the time had come where we recognized that if we wanted to affect change in the state's capital, in how our state public lands are managed, we need to be here at the state capital on a full-time basis, right here where the decisions are being made. So we had reached a point in our size and in the agenda we were trying to achieve where we felt the time was right to make this move.
From its new offices, the Forest Alliance can dedicate more of its time and volunteer force to lobbying for the protection of Indiana forests. According to Stant, they will still maintain some presence in Bloomington, protecting the Hoosier National Forest and other natural resources.
We're going to continue to be most active on issues concerning the management of the state forests and the Hoosier National Forest. And so that means we'll continue to be very present and visible in the Bloomington community and in counties going south all the way to the Ohio River.
The Indiana Forest Alliance headquarters is now located at 2123 North Meridian Street in Indianapolis.
State regulators aren't saying whether Monroe County's new public safety tax is effectively dead on arrival. Today, a spokesperson for the Indiana Department of Local Government Finance acknowledged the tax is, quote, under review, unquote, but refused to reveal further details. Communications Director Jenny Banks told WFHB that her department would refrain from commenting about whether the tax will officially expire at the beginning of 2017, just 3 months after it takes effect. The 0.25% tax was passed earlier this summer with the stated aim of providing funding to the 911 dispatch center, as well as other public safety projects yet to be named. Across the county, fire and police departments have already asked to get a piece of the roughly $7 million a year the tax has been expected to collect from Monroe County workers. Monroe County courts have also expressed an interest in the funding. But the January 1st expiration date could put a kink in those plans. Still, a committee was set to meet tonight, starting at 5:45 p.m., to start deciding how the money might be divided up. The committee is reviewing applications from fire departments located in unincorporated parts of the county.
The Monroe County Solid Waste Management District Board of Directors approved spending $100,000 to hire a consultant to do a feasibility study for a dual-stream materials recovery facility, also referred to as a MRF. In the board's August 4th meeting, the district's executive director, Tom McGlasson, outlined what the consultant will provide.
What's been put in the budget at the recommendation of the executive committee is a $100,000 sum in the consulting line in order to bring somebody from the outside in to help us do some site identification, develop a business plan, and do some engineering studies, to look at how the facility would be designed and help with some construction cost estimates.
McGlasson explained that a dual-stream MRF would handle clean recyclables as well as sort recyclables from trash.
The dual-stream MRF would have, in essence, two separate facilities in it, one processing the source-separated materials from our facilities and wherever else they may be generated from if the facility was operating, as well as a waste stream operation that would involve pulling recyclable materials out of the waste stream before that made it to final disposal facility.
The district had hoped to open a facility at the landfill that processed only recyclables, but a dual-stream operation will need more space. McGlasson noted that recyclables recovered from trash fetch a lower price in the market than clean stream recyclables. The district would prefer to haul its own materials, and the board budgeted for renting two trucks to carry the recyclables in roll-off boxes. However, the district still needs to work through where to store the trucks and the roll-off boxes. McGlasson said storing the trucks at the landfill is an option because it is a secure space with electrical service, but the location is inconvenient. The budget also includes money for hiring two truck drivers at $18.85 an hour. The budget narrowly passed on a 4-3 vote. Board member Iris Kiesling voted yes, but with a comment.
I'm going to vote yes because I would like to see the staff to have some flexibility and to see whether it works, because I would expect if it doesn't work, it's not going to happen. So I would hope that this will give them an opportunity to look, figure out whether it's going to work or not. I'm not a big fan of it because I'm really concerned with, as I've expressed before, how do you deal with trucks that we have no space for? So I don't see it happening, but this gives you the flexibility.
Board members John Hamilton, Patrick Stoffers, and Diana Bastin voted against the budget.
Bloomington's Comprehensive Master Plan, CMP, is now available for public review. The plan will guide the city's environment for the next 5 to 7 years and will be the framework used to make decisions about the future of Bloomington. The plan includes descriptions and action plans in community services, culture, socioeconomics, environment, downtown, housing and neighborhoods, land use transportation, and a multimodal network. 2 town hall meetings will be held in Room 1B at the Monroe County Library so the public can contribute feedback on the plan. The first is tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. The second is Thursday, September 15th, also from 6 to 8 p.m. After these meetings, the city staff will review and revise the plan's working draft to integrate public feedback before submitting the new plan for revision and approval. A working draft of the document is now available on the city's website at bloomington.in.gov. Comments can be sent to planning@bloomington.in.gov. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Doug Storm.
And I'm Maria McKinley. A recent study by Purdue and Indiana University researchers identified more than 900 genes that are linked to alcoholism. WFHB Assistant News Director Sarah Vaughn spoke with the researchers about the study and about how genetic disposition and environment relate to addiction.
Researchers from Purdue and Indiana University have identified more than 900 genes that may contribute to alcoholism in humans. Genetics Professor William Muir of Purdue and neuroscientist Dr. Feng Zhou of IU School of Medicine bred rats specifically for the study. 2 lines were developed, drinkers and non-drinkers.
Head by Larry Lemang and T.K. Lee over 30 years ago started developing these lines of rats. It took a long, long time to be able to get rats to drink to these levels to differentiate them. And the reason that we developed these models is that we wanted to accentuate the differences genetically between drinkers and non-drinkers. That this helps us pinpoint the genetic differences between the lines. Again, this is something we couldn't do with humans. With humans, we just have natural differences between drinkers and non-drinkers, but actually that the genetic differences are relatively small. And with these rat lines, we could greatly magnify the difference, but it did take over 30 years to develop.
And why do researchers use rats?
In terms of the genome, we share well over 90% of the same genes and genomes. And so there's a lot of similarity, over 90% similarity between genes and rats and genes and humans. So it's a convenient model that has high promise of translation of what we find in them to what we find in us.
Muir said there are a number of ways the information from the study can be used.
One is, just to genetically, can we identify the genes that go into contributing to alcohol? Once we understand the genes, we can look at what those genes do and what regulates them. And once we understand that, we can perhaps make drugs that would either that could address alcoholism, or alternatively, we could determine your genetic risk of becoming an alcoholic by testing your genes. We could do a gene profile. And we can look into it and say, well, genetically, you have either high or a low probability of becoming an alcoholic. There's 2 major things that the paper really relates to. And one was the sheer number of genes that we found, over 900. And what this tells us is that this is a complex trait, that there isn't just one gene, or 2 genes, or 3. There's hundreds of genes that go into making up the background of an alcoholic or non-alcoholic. And so each of these genes just contributes a small part. So it, cumulatively, they have a huge effect, but individually it's small. So the downside of that is that finding solutions to the problem may be difficult unless we can target major pathways, you have biological pathways.
The search for a genetic underpinning of alcoholism has been going on for decades. Zoe says early researchers thought diseases were caused by one faulty gene.
In the past, we thought a disease probably is messed up one gene. Very few disease. It was really as a consequence of one gene.
So it compares alcoholism and other diseases to human height, which involves many genes expressed in a variety of ways. So says among the many genes, some carry more weight than others. For example, genes that impact glutamate receptor signaling pathways that affect your sense of reward contribute to addiction.
We did find one major pathway, it's called the glutamate pathway, that was targeted heavily by a lot of our signatures, which suggests that if we can make drug solutions that attack that pathway, we may be able to address it that way.
Zoe adds that the brain's plasticity is also a factor in addiction. The brains of teens and those in their early 20s are still developing. The connections from the frontal cortex and the amygdala are still forming. There's a greater risk of addiction. So the combination of a developing brain on alcohol and a family history of alcoholism results in an addiction that can be very difficult to break.
Earlier age exposure can be a lot more dire. And once they hook up at this age, they become being fixed more so than people who being exposed to alcohol and drug in later adult stage.
Zoe said other genes were identified that mediate stress and immune responses. These genes compel humans to continue to drink to alleviate withdrawal symptoms.
People get hooked up and cannot get out of it.
Muir says we also have to consider environment.
Even if I predicted that genetically you have a 100% chance of becoming an alcoholic, and your chances are close to one, that's just a genetic component. We know that there's a large environmental component that is contributed by your peers, by your family behavior, socioeconomic status. So even if you have a high propensity of becoming an alcoholic, if your family doesn't drink, nobody drinks, you won't become an alcoholic. You just avoid it.
Zoe was also quick to point out that environment is a critical factor in a person's ability to resist drinking to excess.
The environment has very strong input to the expression of the genome. In other words, we are a product of the interaction of the environment and the DNA.
Introduce environmental stress, peer pressure, and the epigenetic interaction can change the coding to result in a gene expression controlling behavior we may be genetically predisposed to.
That is a coding. It's a chemical coding not written on the sequence of the DNA, but right on the top of it. That's why I call epigenetics. That coding can facilitate or regulate the expression of the genes.
Both Zoe and Muir say further studies in humans is a long way off, as is accurate genetic testing to identify those human genes linked to alcoholism. Muir's best advice if you have a family history?
Well, as of this time, we don't have a good genetic test in humans for alcoholism. That's what we're kind of working on. But I would recommend that if a person has a family history of alcoholism, that they actually abstain from alcohol, because they have two factors now contributing to their risk. One is the environmental. They're in an environment where alcohol is consumed, and we know that individuals in those kinds of environments tend to become alcoholics, and we can't distinguish is that because they have genes for alcoholism or if that's simply because they're in an environment where alcohol is accepted. But in either case, it contributes, and the best way to avoid becoming an alcoholic is simply don't drink.
Reporting for WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
That was reporter Sarah Vaughn discussing a recent study by Purdue and Indiana University researchers that identified more than 900 genes linked to alcoholism.
Now it's time for Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community.
Welcome to Activate, featuring tales of inspiration from local citizens who stand up for what they believe in and encouraging you to find your cause, live your passion, make a difference. Volunteer.
Hi, my name is Mary Richardson, and I am a volunteer and serve on the board of directors at the Monroe County Humane Association. The Monroe County Humane Association is a nonprofit organization. We provide humane education and advocate and protect animal welfare. We offer a number of programs and services such as spay and neuter assistance, emergency medical vouchers, and we also partner with other animal welfare organizations in the community to improve the lives of animals and the people in our area. I believe it's important to give back to the community, and I find when you're able to serve your community through something that you're passionate about, you can accomplish something extraordinary. And animal welfare is something that I'm personally invested in. And through the Monroe County Humane Association, I have the opportunity to help advocate for animals and give back to the community. The Monroe County Humane Association helps the community in so many ways. Some are highly publicized, such as the recent Owen County dog hoarding case. We were able to help the Owen County Humane Society rescue and care for 82 dogs. It was so inspiring to work together and see everyone volunteering and donating supplies and just general donations to improve the lives of each of these 82 dogs. And we have other programs that we've implemented that have lifelong impacts. They may seem small, but they have significant influence on people, like a child reading to one of our therapy team dogs at the local library, to we have our VIP therapy teams visiting nursing homes, and those dogs and the people at those places get to benefit from that human-animal interaction. And our minor medical clinic serves low-income families in government assistance programs or who have encountered a financial strain, and we help in caring for their pets afflicted with a routine or a common illness in hopes to keep the animals happy and healthy and then again in the homes where they belong. And regardless of socioeconomic status, people care deeply for their pets and they don't always have access to the services or they struggle to cover the cost. And that's where Monroe County Humane Association comes into play. During one of the recent clinics, an individual came in with her cat and at this particular juncture in her life couldn't afford to give her pet the care she knew it needed at that moment. And while talking with her, she said, "My cat is my best friend." And she said she's always there for me when I come home. And it was such a privilege to be able to help her care for one of her family members. The human-animal bond is such a special relationship, and I am inspired and in constant awe of the staff and the fellow volunteers as we strive to give the animals the life they deserve. Thanks for listening. I'm Mary Richardson, and I volunteer with the Monroe County Humane Association.
You may visit the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network website to see a full organization profile at bloomington.in.gov/volunteer. Now here's a rundown of current volunteer opportunities in Bloomington and Monroe County.
For the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake with three ways to volunteer for the welfare of animals. Do you have a well-behaved pet who loves people? Would you like to share your pet with those in need? Monroe County's VI Paws might just be the program for you. Dedicated, responsible volunteers with well-behaved pets are needed to go through training to become registered pet partner therapy animal teams. Pets Alive's most popular volunteer activity is helping to prepare vaccinations prior to surgeries and the vaccine and wellness clinics. This is an essential task that enables their veterinarian staff to focus on the surgeries. Tasks include preparing syringes with rabies vaccine, cleaning up the prep area, and assisting with general clinic cleanup. And Horse Angels Horse Rescue invites volunteers to offer their time every second and fourth Sunday of the month from 1 to 4 p.m. Duties include cleaning stalls, grooming, and leading the horses for exercise. Working on projects around the property is also helpful. Groups are most welcome to participate together. And that's a look at just some of the ways you can connect to your community through volunteering. For WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake.
You've been listening to Activate, a co-production of WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, working together to build an empowered, vibrant, and engaged community. You may visit bloomington.in.gov/volunteer to find and sign up for local volunteer opportunities. All episodes of Activate are available online at wfhb.org/news/activate. For Bloomington Community Radio, I'm Jennifer Brooks.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Joe Crawford, Kathy Norton, Taylor Haggerty, and Jared Dill, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, our partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Sarah Vaughn.
Activate is produced by Jennifer Brooks with help from Christine Brackenoff, along with the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network. Our engineer is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Doug Storm.
And I'm Maria McKinley. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming, online at wfhb.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned now for Bring It On, our local forum on African American people and culture, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.